Well, good morning, everyone. Oh yeah. Happy Father's Day. So I think everywhere I go, pretty much everybody knows who my dad is. Even today, I went into the washroom, and sorry, I'm bringing this up right now. Somebody turned to me, hey, are you Bill's son? Yep, I'm Bill's son. And that happens to me more often than I guess my dad's a good-looking guy. Happy Father's Day. Guys, I have a small confession to make. When I was 15 years old, I started to play a game called World of Warcraft. For those of you who don't know, World of Warcraft is an online video game, otherwise known as WoW, acronym World of Warcraft, WoW. Millions of players online. One weekend, there's a free trial that started, and I was like, I gotta jump on this free trial. I was 15 years old. So I jumped on, and I made a character, and this is my guy right here. I found him online just for you. He looks sweet, hey? His name is McGildor. His name was McGildor. I'm pretty sure he's no longer with us. But he was an elf character or something. For the next 2 weeks, my life was consumed with World of Warcraft. Consumed. When I was at school, all I could think about was what I was going to do with McGildor in the land of Azeroth. When I was at home, I was on my computer with my bag of chips and my 2-liter Pepsi next door. When my friends invited me out after school, I'm just like, no. I'm pretty sure my mom has something for me to do at home. I'll see you in a month. It didn't take too long before, I think after one marathon gaming session of like 6 hours into the wee hours of the night, I was like, man, this is probably not super good for me. And so I uninstalled World of Warcraft. At the time when I was playing WoW, there was 11 million other people playing it in a world. 11 million. Cumulatively, since they had accumulated 6 million years of playtime. 6 million years of playing World of Warcraft. I did the math. You can walk to the sun, assuming you could stay alive that long, for over 2,000 times. You could walk to the sun. 6 million years of playtime. With these kinds of hours, one must ask, can people become addicted to video games? This morning, we're going to talk about addiction. We have an awesome panelist coming up afterwards, so if you have questions anytime in the morning, text them into that number on screen. But when we talk about addiction, whether it's video games, coffee, golfing, social media, how many people can go a whole day without checking their cell phone? Not to mention, things like pornography or gambling addiction or alcohol or drug addiction. Our culture, our world, seems to be addicted to addictions in some shape or form. The DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, has a few pieces when it looks at substance abuse addictions in particular to identify addictions, and among them are tolerance and withdrawal. Gabor Mate defines addiction this way. It's up on screen. Addiction is any repeated behavior, substance-related or not, in which a person feels compelled to persist, regardless of its negative impact on his or her life and the lives of others. That last half is really important. Regardless of its negative impact on his or her life and the lives of others. When we look at addiction through this lens, it's more than just East Hastings Street in Vancouver. It's more than just Leon Ave downtown. It's not just in back alleys. Addiction crosses cultural and economic divides, and it actually reveals something going on in each of our hearts. Take this definition and just turn it inwards for a moment, and this is probably a little bit uncomfortable. What are those things in your life you know, maybe even good things initially that have become compulsive things that irritate you when you don't get them, that, you know, start to impact your life in a negative way, and maybe the lives of the ones that you care about around you. You know, someone had this to say about their own addiction. When I'm addicted, there's a tremendous amount of drama from the ecstatic rush of the honeymoon period all the way through to the crashing finale. When I realize this is bad for me and it's gotten out of control, I swear it off with a heroic mix of regret, shame, and sober-sounding resolve. Does that sound like anyone? I carry a void inside, nothing exotic, just an ordinary human despair, fear, anxiety factory. And mine will try to feed on anything that gives me an instant sense of self-definition of purpose. If I want to be quippy about it, it's a void I'll do anything to avoid. You know, there was a time when Jesus actually ran into somebody who was trying to fill a void. It was the woman at the well, remember? And this woman had been trying to fill it by going to various different men, having multiple partners, and she runs into Jesus, and Jesus just confronts her. It's like, hey, you know, everyone who drinks of this water, and he's talking about water because she's drawing water from a well, but he's also speaking to deeper things, will be thirsty again. Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water I give them will never thirst. We all, if we look closely enough, are people trying to fill voids in our lives with something that gives us meaning in life? You know, whether that's golf, alcohol, relationships, or World of Warcraft. You know, it's why, as Dr. Eric Kalker from our church would say, that addictions, another definition of addictions, are actually dysfunctional coping methods, you know, dysfunctional ways of filling that void. And some of these dysfunctional ways have had an extreme impact on our society, and we're seeing it today. Last April, so 2016, in BC, the government actually declared a state of emergency because there were the most amount of overdose deaths in 1 month since 2002. And so last April, there's 69 in just the month of April, 69 overdose deaths. If you skip ahead to this year, there's about twice that number. In BC, we're on pace for over 1,400 overdose deaths this year. That's a lot. That's just four or five people every day. When we hear those numbers and hear those statistics, for me at least, Vancouver comes to mind, right, in BC. If we've driven in Vancouver. But if you look at the rates, you know, per capita, outside of Vancouver, the highest overdose deaths in BC is actually right here in the Okanagan. Kelowna, we're second in our province. This year already, in our small wonderful town of Kelowna, there's already been 35 or more overdose deaths. And a lot of these are people that we actually know. You know, there's people in our community who know people. We've attended funerals, we've attended memorials. It's a real thing. I help out at a drop-in center downtown, and last week an ambulance rolled up, sirens blazing, and people from the ambulance rushed outside, and I was hanging out with a group of kids, and as soon as the ambulance came in, it was like a bomb dropped on the group of kids. Three of them ran away. They couldn't deal with it. Two of them went into crisis mode. They ran to check inside the center where the person who OD'd was. It was nuts. Thankfully, it was a false alarm, and it was just two kids taking a nap out back, and there's a concerned person next door, and so that was awesome that was the case. You know, this morning there's so much to talk about when we speak about addiction. There's so much. We're going to try to narrow our focus a little bit and speak about substance abuse addiction, and even in that narrow focus, there's a ton to talk about. but for us to be a community that steps into God's redemptive work here in our city, we need to move past maybe an us versus them mindset. We need to move past this and actually take up a posture that Jesus takes up and see past the addiction and start to see the person. Start to see the person. Can you join me and pray? Gracious God, a phrase that has come to me this week over and over as I've looked into this, God, is do what only you can do in our hearts, in our town, in our city, in our province, in our country, God. We come to you broken people in need of a Redeemer who restores us. So gracious God, speak to our hearts. Speak your grace, your truth, your hope into our lives this morning. Amen. Amen. It's great. If you have a Bible with you, please turn to Luke 15. If you don't have a Bible with you, check in front of you on page, what is it, page 726? You know what we should start doing is the first person to flip there can yell out the page number. That would be good. That would make me feel more at home, like in youth group. 726. This is Jesus speaking. And the first verse is going to be up on screen here. But some of the other verses won't. So just stay in Luke 15. And we'll go through there in a little bit. All right, so this is the first verse. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Okay, Luke, the author, when describing the scene at hand, is sure to point out to us what's happening. It's the type of people who are drawing near, who are coming to Jesus. Right? There's two. He says it's the tax collectors. And if you know kind of first century what's going on here, the tax collectors were Jewish people, but they present... discarded their entire culture and sided with the Romans so that they could make a profit off the backs of their brothers and sisters. That was kind of the one group, so they weren't highly thought of back then. And the second group, the sinners, is this term. Luke's not just saying these are the only sinners in the group here. Luke's saying that this group of sinners is kind of like the lowest of the society. The people that others wouldn't be seen associating with. And Jesus associated with them quite a bit. And so in this group, you have the tax collectors and the sinners. Look at what Jesus does. And he actually points this out. This man welcomes sinners and eats with them. He welcomes sinners and eats with them. Jesus sees the one struggling, and Jesus sits with them. He sees and he sits. He invites the sinners into his midst and shares a meal with them. He begins to talk with them, to listen to them. Jesus is sharing with us a posture of how we are to treat people, everyone. He's sharing with us a posture of how we are to go into places, to see and to sit. See and to sit. So we're going to do that. We're going to just take a moment to see and to sit in a few brief stories people who might find themselves in a struggling position. And these are just really short paragraph little stories. And so I'm just going to read a couple here. "I didn't use for 6 years, says Kathy, 42-year-old heroin and cocaine user, back in a grubby downtown Eastside hotel after a long absence. She's contracted HIV since her return. The whole 6 years I craved. It was the lifestyle. I thought I was missing something. And now I look around myself and think, what in the world was I missing?" She didn't actually say that. Kathy reveals that when she wasn't using, she missed not only the effect of the drugs, but also the excitement of drug seeking and the rituals the drug habit entails. "I just didn't know what to do with myself. I felt empty." Another man. "I asked 57-year-old Richard, an addict since his teens, why he kept using. I don't know. I'm just trying to fill a void, he replied. Emptiness in my life, boredom, lack of direction, I knew all too well what he meant. Here I am in my late 50s, he said. I have no wife, no children. I appear to be a failure. Society says you should be married and have children, a job, you know, that kind of stuff. This way, with cocaine, I can sit there and do some little things like rewire the toaster that wasn't working and not feel like I've lost out on life. Richard died a few months after our interview, succumbing to a combination of lung disease, kidney cancer, and an overdose. He could go on and on, sharing different stories of different reasons in different circumstances with different people from different backgrounds. The more and research I've done on addiction, the more I've interacted with people who are living in it and walking in it, the more I've been pushed to see that addiction is an incredibly complex issue that cannot be simplified to just making a few bad decisions. The cause for addiction, you know, the reason why people remain in cycles of addiction is a complex mix, psychological, biological, and social factors. There's a lot going on. You know, environment matters, stress factors matters, decisions matters. For a small segment of people, chemical predisposition matters, how our brain responds to certain chemicals matters. It is complex. And there's this complex, and while there's so many factors that contribute to substance abuse addictions, a lot of the research draws our attention into one area. The researchers have examined something called ACEs. ACEs are adverse childhood experiences and the relationship to mental illness and addictions. ACEs tend to be traumatic events, you know, such as the death of a loved one, separation of parents, different types of abuse and neglect, and other high stress, high trauma events. Research shows that the more types of adverse childhood experiences one has, the higher the likelihood of developing different mental illnesses and substance use disorders. Studies show that ACEs seem to account for upwards of one half to two thirds of serious problems with drug use. This does not mean that everyone who experiences childhood trauma becomes an addict or that all addiction is rooted in ACEs, but it does show a strong correlation between the two. And the reason why I think we need to start talking about this, and the reason why we need to do more homework, and we all need to do more homework, is that for us to step into God's healing work, we need to begin to see past the addiction and see the person. We need to begin to see the full person, the full story, whatever that may be, whatever situation, whatever circumstance that may be. Maybe right now, some of you are feeling a tinge of hopelessness. And you know this. You know, we look at this, but know this. There is hope. In all circumstances, there is hope. Chains can be broken. Freedom can be found. Transformation can happen. Maybe you have a child or a loved one who is going down this road and you have no idea why. For the life of you, you've tried, you've worked, and you were wondering what you could do. Maybe what you didn't do, maybe you're feeling guilt, maybe some shame. Many times there are no easy answers. The grace of God is big enough for all of us, whatever situation we find ourselves in, and that's what Jesus is doing. Jesus sees you, sees me, sees us right now, sees you in your pain, your confusion, and he sits with you. He hears our stories, he sits with us, and then he shares a story of his own. He shares a story of his own. And this is the story that he shares. If you're in Luke 15 still, flip ahead just to 11. He's told two stories. Now he's jumping to a third, and the third is a story that I believe most of us are familiar with. Most of us have probably heard it in one shape or form, and this is the story of what's typically called the prodigal son. Better definition or name of the story is the prodigal sons, or just the story of the two sons. Because what Jesus does is he's contrasting two groups of people. We see that in verse 11 and 12. 11 and 12. Jesus continued, shares the story. There was a man who had two sons. There was a man who had two sons. The younger son said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." And so he divided his property between them. All right, got an older man, obviously somewhat wealthy, two younger sons. Back in the day, how it worked is that the older son got 2/3 of the inheritance. The younger son got 1/3 of the inheritance. And just like in today, when do you get the inheritance? Oh yeah, we can call back. Oh, when the person passes away, right? When the father goes away. So this is pretty harsh. I think we can take a moment to acknowledge how harsh the young son is. In effect, the young son goes up to his dad. "Happy Father's Day, Dad. I wish you were not here. Give me all your stuff." I could not say that to my dad. That's harsh. Younger son goes off with his newfound wealth, right? So obviously the father sold off 1/3 of his belongings, gave the money over to his younger son. Goes off and into the city and squanders it on what Jesus calls reckless living. You can kind of put into there what you want. Trying to fill life where he thought there was joy, you know, trying to fill his life, attempting to fulfill his desires. The young man eventually was left with nothing, you know, right? No money, no family, no friends. He found himself feeding pigs, wishing that he had what the pigs had. Man, how do you think the young man found himself in that moment? How do you think he saw himself? Right? I bet words like failure came to mind. Unwanted, unlovable, a screw up. Man, I always screw up. I always get into a position like this. Why do I keep on doing this? Worthless, man. And he's looking at his situation. He's looking at the slop. And he's like, "Oh, okay. You know what? I don't think my dad will accept me back into his family. But I think my dad might let me work for him." So he comes up with an idea. He comes up with a reason why his dad should hire him back, not as a son, but as just a hired worker. And he, all these things. And then he goes back to his father. Verse 20 picks up. "So he, the younger son, got up and went to his father. But while the younger son was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against you and against heaven. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For the son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And so they began to celebrate." The younger son did not see himself as valuable, worthwhile, deserving of anything. But how did the father see him? "This is my son. He was dead and is alive again. He is lost and was found. Throw him a feast. Clothe him with my robes. He is one of my own. Put a ring on his finger." That means he can pretty much sign off on things, saying he's one of the family. He is one of his own. Maybe you see yourself as the younger son. You know, too far gone, maybe. Ashamed, worthless. Maybe you see yourself as an addict, as a pornographer, as somebody who is unfaithful, somebody who is unlovable. Guess what? God sees you. He runs out to you and meets you. And he does not see the addict or the unfaithful. He sees his daughter. He sees his son. He says, "Hey, welcome home. Welcome into my family. You are loved. You are cherished." Jesus wants us to see the Father like he sees the Father. It's interesting that we use God the Father, because typically when I think of Father, I would never call my father Dad unless I was angry with him. It's like, yes, Father. And I think we do that because Father, for me at least, seems like an impersonal kind of removed term. Father is over here. Dad is like right here. And so when I read Father in the text, I have a hard time thinking of a father who is not impersonal, who's not cold, who's not standoffish. You know, fathers are strong and just, and they'll take care of you, but will they, like, reach out and hug me and love me? It's like, Jesus wants us to see the Father as he sees the Father, loving, kind, both majestic and meek, long-suffering. This is God the Father. And maybe you haven't experienced what it's like to have a good father. Maybe you've had a great father. Maybe you've lived through, you know, different traumatic experiences growing up. God sees you. He wants to embrace you. He wants to embrace all of your hurts and tell you that you are loved, that you are not worthless, that you are worth his time. Do you know the Father? Do you know this Father? But the story, it's not done with this. It's not done with this great reunion, you know, movie, Hollywood moment of the son coming back home, the dad beating him. It's not done with that. Remember the elder son at the beginning. The father had two sons. The elder son was out in his field working, being a hard worker, when the younger son came back home and his dad started throwing a party. The elder son, obviously, hey, what's all this commotion? What's going on? And servant says, they're throwing a party. Your younger son's back, or your brother's back. Great. Except elder son is both angry and refused to go in. The father, this is neat, the father goes out to meet the elder son just like he went out to meet the younger son. This is what, and asks him to come in. Hey, come in. Your brother's back. We're having a party. Elder son responds, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes come home, you kill the fattened calf for him. Dad, why are you doing all this? He's been disobeying you. I've been here the whole time slaving away. Oh, I find myself in the elder brother way too often. Quick to justify my resentments of those who don't follow the rules as well as I do. You know, quick to judge others' inability to live a life worth living. Quick to assess someone based off what I initially see. Quick to avoid sin because that's how I think I get God. I have a tendency to get angry when people don't get what they deserve, actually. Some people would say this is just, but it's both ways. So, you know, whether that's hard work, working people deserving good stuff, or bad living people deserving punishment. I think most of us in this room, if pushed, could identify with the older brother in some way or form. You know, lives collected, lives lived well, rules kept, good deeds done, and yet, do you find yourself outside of the party? When the younger son left the family farm, what piece was missing from the story? This is neat. When the younger son left the family farm, what piece is missing? What should have happened in a healthy family unit? The elder son should have turned to his dad and said, hey, Dad, I'm going to go look out for my younger bro to make sure he's safe, maybe bring him back home if he's not safe. It's interesting. He should have made sure that his younger brother was okay. And when he didn't do that, and when the younger son came back home and the father invited him in, he threw him a party to celebrate what had happened. And that party, incredibly expensive party. They wouldn't eat meat very often in this time. And when they did eat meat, they would never eat a fattened calf. The fattened calf was reserved for like the big parties, the public parties. And so for them to eat a fattened calf in a private party is a huge expensive deal. When the father invited the younger son back in, it actually cost something to invite the younger son back in and throw that party, right? It cost that whole expense. And yet the cost, it wasn't to the father, was it? Because everything that the father now owned was essentially the elder brothers, the elder son. Because he would inherit everything that was left, right? The third had gone to the younger bro, everything was left. So when his dad threw the younger son a party, it was at the elder brother's expense. That fattened calf, that whole party is at the elder brother's expense. No wonder he was a little bit angry. That's my stuff you're messing with, Dad. Get your hands off. The other elder brother failed to live up to his role. He did not live up to his role as the elder son. He did not go out and find the younger brother. He did not sacrifice his own to bring the younger son back in. And how I fail quite often as the older brother. You know, concerned too much at what I can get, or when that phone call rings and I know who it's from and I know they're going to be asking something for me, I just click the button and flip it over so I don't see it. Thank God we have a true, unfailing elder brother. Thank God that Jesus is our elder brother who goes out after us when we run away from him. Thank God that Jesus goes out and finds us and brings us back at his own expense. And not just sacrificing a piece of his inheritance, but actually sacrificing his entire self so that we could be brought back in. And it's in Jesus that we can be called sons and daughters of the Most High, because on the cross, instead of Jesus dying as a son of God, Jesus died as an outsider. God forsake Jesus, the Son. Jesus died as an outsider so that we, you and I, might no longer need to be outsiders, so that we could be sons and daughters of God. Oh, goodness, right actions, all these things don't get us into God's family. Jesus does. Lay your deadly doing down at Jesus' feet. Stand in him alone, gloriously complete. Take a breath. Breathe in the glorious grace of Jesus Christ our Lord. Of the elder brother stepping in on your behalf, of seeing you, of sitting with you, and of saving you. That's incredible. Because it is only in that place can we ask the next question. And as we close, we're going to ask this question. How do you see the younger brother? Do you see them as children of God? Do you see them in their hurt, in their complexities, with their dreams and ambitions, or do you only see their faults, their addictions, their issues? Are you modeling the posture of Jesus and sitting with, interacting with, eating with those who are struggling? You know, those who are often on the outside looking in. Right now, I know of a handful of youth in the city who have no place to stay because they're only given $500 a month from the ministry, and no landlord wants to take a ministry kid. And so they're either stuck in a shelter, which isn't good, or they're stuck on the street. Are we seeing these people? Are we seeing these children of God? Maybe, actually, this is closer to home than you'd like. Maybe you're forced to see what's going on. Someone you love, you know, you're forced to see what addiction has done to someone you love, and you've actually gone out of your way to help them, and you haven't actually seen a change. You know, you're at your end of the rope. There's hopelessness, comes knocking more often than you'd like. There's no easy solution. You know, even if the addiction is tackled, there's typically a host of other things that need to be walked in. But it needs to begin with you first seeing yourself as Jesus sees you. Out of that place, seeing. It's tough. It's tough. And for our community, this is important. Do we, as a community see our younger brother? Do we invite those who are on the outside in? Does our community look like a good mix of elder and younger brothers? We need to be a community that it's safe to stand up and say, hey, I have a problem with addiction. And for us not to instantly condemn them as a sinner, but for us to step alongside of them, help them. That's where we need to start. And I think we are, honestly, guys, I think we are taking steps. You know, even something like helping out with the Pregnancy Care Center, huge step. What's going on with CREATE, huge step. I know in the Empower groups, there's different stories that we'll even hear this morning. These are big steps of children being adopted, right? Relationships being made. Healing is happening. You know, it's a massive issue. As addiction and substance abuse addiction, it is a massive issue. And there's so many stigmas surrounding it. But we need to start with the place of how Jesus sees us, how we are children, sons and daughters of the Most High. And out of that place, going from there and saying, hey, how can I see you, the full you, everything around, not just the issue, not just the problem, but all of you. How can I see you? How can I sit with you? All right? Hearing stories. Hey, you need a place to stay? Hey, this is where it starts. There's no simple answer for a complex solution, but there is a step that we can take as a community. And I think that's the place where we can start. Let's pray. God, thank you for seeing us in our hurt, in our need. Thank you for sitting with us, Jesus, and thank you for saving us on the cross. It's only by your sacrifice that we are brought back into the family, and so, God, we thank you and we love you for that. Jesus, as we continue to engage in the rest of this morning, I pray that it be fruitful. I pray that some questions are answered, God, but also that more questions are stirred within us. God, prompt those of us who maybe don't have hands-on interactions with this, prompt us into action. God, give grace to those who are dealing with this right now, even in this moment today, this week. So Jesus, we thank you and we pray these things in your precious name. Amen. Amen. Thank you. All right, well, panelists, I'm going to invite them forward, and we're in for an incredible Q&A session. Yes, come on forward, Melissa. Don't be shy. That's good. I know, yeah, so if you have questions, text them in, and we're going to kind of start this. I'll introduce the panelists as they come forward. Here, Dave. And that's you, Lloyd. Oh, yeah, that would be funny. Three on a couch? That'd be real good. Real good. So, Melissa Feddersen on the end there. Melissa is a registered nurse. She leads up the youth, child and youth mental health and substance abuse committee at the at UBCO, correct?
That's two jobs, but yeah, I do. I was in charge of the health programs at UBC for a few years, and then I'm also project lead for the Child and Youth Mental Health Collaborative.
Right, too. Yeah. And she's also the director of the Foundry. The Foundry is a new CMHA facility that's opening up sometime soon, and it's an all-in-one facility for youth ages 12 to 24 who are experiencing mental illness and substance abuse issues. And so it's a range from, you know, finding housing to counseling to dealing with addiction. It's everything. It's very cool that she's here. Dave was like the second person I had coffee with when I showed up on staff, and Dave's the best. He's a gem. He's a welder up in north of Fort McLeod right now. Dave has an interesting history, has a tough history with struggling with different substance abuse. He's been clean for 13 and a half years.
That's right.
Go, Dave. And he has a neat story of how God transformed his life. And so we'll hear a little bit of that. And here closest to me is Lloyd. Lloyd works at Freedom's Door, which is a group home for men who are struggling with addiction here in Kelowna. You guys have five homes?
Five homes, and we house up to 50 people at a time, yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible. And Dave's been doing that for about 14 years now. And so in between these three, we have an incredible resource here today. And so we have a couple questions, and we're just going to jump right into it, if that's cool. You know, let's start with you, Lloyd. For the person who's struggling with addiction, what is one of the most helpful things that you've seen that can help them make a meaningful change?
Yeah, you talked about some of it, Brendan, in your talk today. One of the things that happens to anyone that's been in addictions for a long time is they really get to a place where they don't believe in their life, they don't believe in themselves anymore, they don't believe that there's a way out. They don't think that they have the ability to do it. So, you know, we at Freedom's Door, and I think any of the mental health places or the recovery places that I know of in Kelowna, we try to motivate them to the belief that they can get to different outcomes. You know, part of the reasons that they, young children that get into addiction, for whatever reasons, get to places where they want to commit suicide is because they've tried so often on their own and they can't do it. So, you know, we as a Christian recovery home, we're lucky that we can tell them about the power of God, because they have a lot of days when they don't have any power. So we point them towards a power that has power all the time and a greater power than themselves.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we just motivate them towards hope. You know, God says that no matter what you've been through, no matter what your life has looked like, everything is just kind of attached to your outside. And that core piece that God built when he created you has not been damaged. And the scripture says we have a good plan for your life and God has a good direction for your life. You can get there with help.
Thanks, Lloyd. Dave, I know we've chatted a little bit, and so maybe you can just share a couple highlights of your of how God kind of met you and different areas he used you and, you know.
Sure.
Yeah, super open.
Yeah, hi, friends. My name's Dave, and I'm a grateful recovering addict. That's how I would introduce myself at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. Yeah, I've always had God in my life, and I've known he's there and had his hand on me, but, you know, I chose to follow my own will and do my own thing, and it led me to some chaotic places in my life, like brushes with death and you know, shame and guilt that Brendan touched on. And yeah, I, you know, like moved away from my family. You know, I was just in a bad place. And I did reach out to God at different times, but it was always just, you know, more of a selfish, get me out of this one, please, Lord, help me. And, you know, and he did. You know, I had contemplated suicide before, like you touched on, and I got to, the third time in jail, I wound up doing Alpha in jail, and I got introduced to Christianity and what it is and what it can do. And so, you know, I got it even closer, but as I got released, I knew I'd had enough pain and suffering that I wanted to change my life. So a friend of mine was on a panel, someone that I had known since I was like 12 years old, and he had 13 years clean. Just before I'd gone into jail, I had met him and realized that he had done it through NA. So I had made a decision that I wanted to change my life. And I come out and I went into Miracle Valley down on the coast, and I came home here and I immersed myself with Narcotics Anonymous. And my mom, bless her soul, she got me to come to this church, and she had informed me that people in this church were praying for me long before I ever came here. So I met these people as time went on, and you know, in April of that year, I gave my life to Christ, and I've been continuing to come here, and God has changed me in amazing ways. And my mom was a big part of that. She was a huge anchor in my life, and You know, in Narcotics Anonymous, they talk of a God of our understanding. I choose to call my God Jesus Christ, who saved me. And, you know, all things are possible through Jesus Christ, who strengthens me. I cleaned up at 40. I had nothing but a bicycle. I mean, I had had a lot of stuff before, but I lost it all. So, you know, I've reinvented myself completely. And, you know, it's by the grace of God, there go I. I've lost two friends recently to addiction, and my nephew I had lost years back now. It's been like 10 years ago now. And, you know, it's awful. It's an awful disease, and it could have happened to me very easily and almost did. So, you know, I'm really grateful to be here, and I'm really grateful to have the life I have today and am able to help others.
Thanks, Dave. That's awesome. Yeah. Melissa, well, I'll just read the question. If I have a child struggling with substance abuse or addiction, what are some practical first steps I could take?
I was thinking about that. The other thing I do in my life is my husband is the youth pastor at Willow Park Church. So we've been in the youth ministry for 18 years with Willow Park, and church, we're perfectly equipped for this. This is where we should be running the strongest, because when we think about how to intervene early with kids or what our protective factors look like, it's caring adults. It's the people praying in the pews for these kids. It's the people that notice when these kids are here. It's the people that take them under their wing and watch out for them. Caring adults, one single caring adult in the life of a child that's at risk of substance abuse is enough to change the whole trajectory of that kid's life. And when I got saved, started going to church, same thing happened to me. The lady walked up to me and said, out of your family, I'd been praying for you since you were born. And I was the first among hopefully a few generations in my family line. But church, this is what we're built for and the community that we can build around it. But when we start to see a youth struggling, I think the other piece we need to do is to prophesy. Well, that's also what we're built for. And by that, I mean to speak what we know that the life and hope will look like over these young people. Mm-hmm. It isn't about foretelling the future, but it is to speak life over these kids and to remind them of the gifts that we have seen in them before they forget. There's a book called Reviving Ophelia, Saving the Selves of Adolescent Girls, and what we know is at age 12, young women will just forget who they are, and they forget the gifts that you've seen recklessly lived in them for so long, and start being more influenced by the world around them instead of what we know to be true in their gifts and abilities. So how do we continue to prophesy over them, the things we've noticed in their childhood that we know who they are, to remind them when they start to forget, to create spaces to, wherever you can, to create spaces to remind them of who they are. So Gord Neufeld's book, Hold On to Your Kids, gotta read it, gotta live that for all parents. As long as we can keep creating spaces to draw close to our kids, to keep them from fully finding their identity in any other communities, and removing them if they've gotten into some of those toxic ponds that we see kids start to swim in. How can we surround them with caring adults, with people who will speak life over them, with friends who will help them, to strengthen them, to make strong choices? So if we're talking about early intervention, I think that was your question. Those would be my...
That's great. Thoughts. Thanks, Melissa. This is a question about, marijuana and the legalization of marijuana. Oh, hey there, microphone. And it being a gateway drug to other harder drugs. Who would feel equipped to... Melissa, how would you... Do you have any thoughts? As the gateway, or Melissa or Lloyd.
I can talk about what I know. I think marijuana is 340 chemicals found nowhere else in nature. So what we don't know about marijuana is a lot more than what we do know about marijuana. And so there's probably, as we're starting to starting to research it, which is a new aspect of the research, which we haven't done yet. But as we're starting to, as with most things, we'll probably find some things are okay about it and some things are dangerous about it. But we don't know that yet, right? And we're starting to see linkages. And so there's the science is waffly on this topic. In fact, for some people, there's starting to be some publications come out that talk about that actually it can reduce risk of if for people that are at risk of heroin addiction, and that it can reduce the risk. So I think there's a lot to learn about it, is what I would say about that. But when we see a kid starting to use substances to cope with their life, then we need to take a deeper look at what's going on for them and what we could do to surround them, because the substance is only a symptom of what's going on and what they're trying to cope with. It's not about this. If they're using alcohol or marijuana, it doesn't really matter. It's a matter of the fact that there's something going on in their head or heart that they're trying to cope with.
Yeah,
a couple of things that my son, I'm also a recovering addict myself, and one of my sons has been smoking marijuana for quite a few years, started because of the lifestyle that he had with his dad. But one of the things is he's very emotionally easy to break down. He has never learned to deal with his feelings, because whenever he starts feeling something, he smokes some marijuana. So the point is that when struggle and hardship happens in his life, he just has absolutely no idea how to deal with it. And also some of the studies that we've been seeing over the last little while for adults later on in life that have smoked marijuana as children is that high percentages of them show that they end up with mental health diseases such as schizophrenia. A Swedish study basically showed that 70% of their study subjects smoked marijuana when they were children, and they ended up having some level of schizophrenia later on in life.
Yeah, there's a lot of.
Can I just touch on what I think?
Yeah, jump in, Dave. Go for it.
I had many experiences with marijuana, and I think that easier access is just going to give it the same access that the kids have today with alcohol, you'll be able to have with marijuana. Not to say it isn't that easy to, or hard to get now, but I think it will become easier. And it's also going to present a stigma that it's okay. You can buy it in the store, it's all good. So whether it's a gateway drug, for sure. I started smoking pot, and I started drinking, and I led myself to other things. So for me, it was.
Yeah, I think one of the big things, and I think Melissa touched on this, and Lloyd did as well, there's Paul says something about, I will not be mastered by anything, and this idea of coping, and where we see it, like, can we get through a day without a drink or two at home? That's a sign of a dysfunctional coping method with alcohol, right? And if we can't. And so I think we're going to start seeing that as well with marijuana when that becomes legalized, because that's just the world we live in. And so taking steps for that. So we got a few more questions. But before we ask any more questions, I'm mindful of the time, and we want to do something just a little bit special. We're going to ask a few more questions. But so Melissa hears from the Foundry, as I said, and Lloyd from Freedom's Door, and Freedom's Door people are set up outside, so feel free to chat with them afterwards. But we want to bless them as a community, just as a very small step, and financially. So we're going to have a special offering being taken, and all the money given, we're going to give 100% to both these. So 50, well, not 100% both, right? That's, the math doesn't add up. But we'll split it 50-50 to Freedom's Door and the Foundry, the new Foundry initiative. And so if you have a few spare change, a few bucks, feel free to put that in. So the ushers will come forward and just kind of collect that special offering now. If you're like, man, I would want to give, I know you can just Google how to give to CMHA, the Foundry. I was on there this morning, and same thing with Freedom's Door on their website. So feel free to do that. Just kind of before we leave, Well, a few things, yeah. So, just a quick question for Lloyd. Is it ever worthwhile to give money to an addict on the or to somebody addicted on the street? If not, what is the best alternative to help them in the moment?
Yeah, we have adopted policies where we try to get Christian people to mentor our men all the time. And one of the things that we do tell them is not to put money in their hand. It usually doesn't go towards the right place. So we do say, you know, as God says, if someone's hungry, take them and feed them. You know, if they need some shoes, please help them find shoes. If you can love them, please try to love them, because I think that's usually what's lacking in their lives more than anything else.
Yeah.
But putting money into their hands, from our experience, we get to be very good cons. We get to be very good manipulators when we need our drugs. As many even parents, mothers, fathers in this room know, when we are desperate for our drugs, we will say anything to get that money that we need. So putting cash into an addict's hands is not usually a good idea.
And just kind of in relation, there's a question was asked, in reality, how can we really see the person? You can show kindness without giving money. You can see the person. You can ask, like, first of all, do you know their name? That's a great question to start, and sharing a little bit of your life, because it's a relationship, right? If it's closer to home, it's a whole other realm. But it's building a relationship, and relationships are always built on asking how they're doing, how what they're interested in, all that different stuff. When I hang out with kids and or youth in this kind of world, the majority of them have some history or are currently using different substances. But I love just chatting with them about music and how that leads to other things, to deeper conversations about their family, where they're living, all those different things. As we wrap up, I'm going to give you guys just a little chance to say just a closing remark or something that you'd like to say. Just a quick question. Somebody asked, where do you help for porn? There's a wonderful website called fightthenewdrug.org. Just Google that, fightthenewdrug.org. If you watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Terry Crews, just a spokesperson for it. Nobody's laughing, that's okay. Thank you, up there. Two people. It's great. So, maybe start with Lloyd, and then we can end with Melissa. Just kind of any closing remarks. If not, that's okay.
Thank you so very much for bringing this addictions to the format here in your church. We so appreciate that. People have preconceived ideas about all this. But we see people being saved all the time, saved from addictions, because of the love of people like yourselves and the love of God. Just last week, many of you have been to see The Shack in the last little while. You've read the book The Shack. Paul Young, the author of The Shack, came up to where we had our men camping last week, and he came up to meet with us because his nephew had just graduated our addictions program, now has 4 months clean, and was baptized in the lake while Paul was there. And Paul was crying as his nephew was baptized and finding a new life. This is what we know that we can accomplish with Christ. We've been to too many funerals of 20 and 24-year-old children the last little while that just wanted to have a good time. And 4 people a day. And I know all their parents. I know that they cry day after day and week after week and month after month at the loss of their sons and their daughters. And so if you would try to intervene in a person's life that is lost or is struggling, you can change their world. So thank you for thinking about doing that today.
Thanks, Lloyd.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've gone to Freedom Store a couple of different times for graduations, and it's a wonderful place. They really do exemplify the Lord there, which, you know, in Narcotics Anonymous, they allude to God as you understand him, or a higher power. Well, I choose to call my higher power Jesus Christ. And it's funny because in over time, people do eventually come to God. A lot of them do. They don't start out with it. They have a hard time with it. The third step says there's a third step prayer that says, take my will and my life, guide me in my recovery, and show me how to live clean. And it is an amazing thing to see people come to God and really get it. But it's a hard thing to get past. You need to have an amount of clean time to really start to understand that you can do this and have the hope. And it's all about hope. It's a hard thing to do on your own. The biggest thing I had to surrender to was the fact that I needed help to do this. And when I finally made that decision and was more than willing and was honest and open-minded about doing this, it changed my life exemplary. Like, I can't stress enough how much Narcotics Anonymous and, of course, Jesus Christ has changed my life and has taken me out of the depths of addiction. Like, we choose to call it a disease. Many years ago, they used to take people and put them in hospitals and give them partial lobotomies, electric shock therapy, and treated it as a moral dilemma. And it works for me. It works for countless others to think that it's a disease and that I can, the symptoms, like was alluded to here, are drugs. And so when you take the drugs away, now I have an emotion problem, now I have a mental problem, now I have issues that I have to go through. And the steps in Narcotics Anonymous has helped with that. Sometimes you need more than that. Sometimes you need outside help, but it can be done. I cleaned up when I was 40. And so, you know, it's not too late. It's not too early. It is possible. And yes, prayer and intervening with Christ is amazing. So pray for others. Pray for the ones. Talk to people. Get help if you have a loved one. Ask questions. It saved many lives. Narcotics Anonymous is in 140 countries now this year. In the last month, there's two more countries. Iran has something like 8,000 meetings a day. It's amazing what goes on. And these are all people that never have a chance on the common meeting. So I'm just blessed to be here. Thank you.
Next stage. Types of ill kids, and we don't do well with taking care of families in the long term, which some of these illnesses that these families are facing together are the long term. So Foundry Kelowna isn't going to solve this. I get email after email of, we're trying to transform access. We're trying to get rid of some of the dangerous gaps in the system that we currently have where we're losing a lot of kids. But a lot of the emails I'm getting are not people who don't have access to healthcare. It's living life through this illness, through this disease trajectory, through this really traumatic experience. And we need to do better as a church and as a community at surrounding families who are struggling in this way and really coming alongside them. And so thanks for partnering with Foundry Kelowna, and I would just challenge you to continue to loving your people well and to surrounding each other. When we look at Stats across Canada, 75% of our young people are talking about loneliness. Yeah. That's what we're built for as a church. And loneliness is as bad for our health as cigarettes, obesity, all those things. So if loneliness is what our community is struggling with, then we need to get better at providing that remedy, because that's what we're called to do as a church too.
Great guests. Let's give a round of applause for our panel. And thank you for being here. Thank you for staying a little bit late with us. As we go from here, remember that this is not the church. This is the gathering of the church, and we go being the church who sees, who sits with, and who comes alongside of Jesus in the work here in Kelowna. So let's go as that. Thanks.